Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce on Noon Forum. We'll hear an address by former Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives and founder of the Center for Health Transformation, Newt Gingrich. Congressman Gingrich's remarks were given as the keynote address at the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce's 2009 annual meeting. His topic will be Creating a 21st Century Intelligent Health System in Nebraska. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday afternoon, January 21st, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Wayne Sensor, Chief Executive Officer of Allegiant Health.
Former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich is a man who understands the need for leadership. And one of the things I find remarkable about Speaker is it doesn't matter what the venue is or what the topic is. From immigration to energy policy to an approach and different delivery for healthcare, this man is an expert in a wide variety of contents. I got to tell you, I don't know that there is a challenge out there that former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich won't tackle. This man, since retiring from Congress in 1999, has become a thought leader in everything from national defense to transformation of healthcare. His leadership and that of his Center for Healthcare Transformation are widely acclaimed as having developed and supported the use of health savings accounts, as well as substantial Medicaid reform. Recently, Speaker Gingrich said this about our financial bailouts, and I find this fascinating. I'm going to quote this directly. Quote, Congress was designed by the founding fathers to move slowly and precisely, to avoid the sudden panic of a one-week solution that becomes a 20-year mess, end quote. It's this kind of bold leadership and outspoken leadership that was the hallmark of Speaker Gingrich's 20 years in Congress, four of which he served as Speaker of the House. He is widely acclaimed as having saved Medicare from bankruptcy. He led serious reform of the FDA. He is a sought-after expert in a wide variety of topics. He is a prolific author in his own right. He is a regular guest on many news shows, and particularly Fox News. And yes, Newt, my father calls me every time you're on Fox News. Time magazine, in naming him Man of the Year in 1995, said, I quote, leaders make things possible. Exceptional leaders make them inevitable. Newt Gingrich belongs in the category of exceptional. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the man the Washington Times calls the indispensable leader, former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich.
Thank you, Wayne. I appreciate very much the chance to be here and to talk with this remarkable turnout. I am delighted, Governor, to be back with you again and look forward very much to returning as, I guess, part of the Omaha experience. We will be bringing our Center for Health Transformation membership here in March and have a very exciting meeting set up working both with Allegiant and Gallup and others. And so we're delighted to be back and looking, for example, at what Nebraska is doing as a real leader on health information technology on a statewide basis. So we are delighted to have a chance to come and share ideas and to build on the work you're already doing in the Healthy Omaha Project. I also do want to take just a moment and say to General Mrs. Chilton, thank you for everything you've done to serve America, and please thank all the men and women who are working 7 days a week to keep this country safe, who are in your command, and it's great to be with you here. I'm supposed to talk about health, and I'll get around to it in a minute, but when I came in, Wayne said to me that it was likely a few of you'd like to have me comment briefly on the inauguration and the larger things that are going on. It was very interesting. Clista and I had the honor yesterday of being at the Capitol and being part of that process, which is a remarkable experience. My first inauguration was 1980 with Ronald Reagan replacing Jimmy Carter. I think inaugurations are particularly emotionally powerful when the parties change hands, because it is a reminder that for the last 225 years, we have been the longest practicing system in the world of voluntarily transferring power and allowing the people of the United States to own the instruments of power. It's always a remarkable thing. Yesterday had two or three additional characteristics I want to share with you. One is, and I was struck with this as somebody who had represented Atlanta for 20 years and who got to see a number of folks who came from what was in many ways the heart of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. I think it's very, very hard for any non-African American, white, Latino, Asian, it's very hard to understand the depth of excitement and the scale of change in one lifetime. To go from parts of the country which were legally segregated to such a degree that people could not vote, had limited job opportunities, had no protection under the law, could not stay in a hotel, could not go in a restaurant, could not find a bathroom. Colin Powell once told me what it was like as a young officer on the way to his first assignment, knowing he would ultimately go to Vietnam, to drive through the South at a time when there were literally cities in which there were no hotels he could stay in. And I think, from that standpoint, it's very hard for us to appreciate the depth of emotion and the depth of energy that the inauguration of President Obama meant. Second, I think almost every American, whatever your background, obviously I'm a conservative Republican, and in many ways I would disagree with President Obama about policy. But I think every American of every background can take pride in the fact that across the world today, people are being reminded that you can have a father from Kenya and a mother from Kansas. You can be raised largely by your grandmother and grandfather in Hawaii. You can, by dint of scholarship, go to two of our finest universities. And in one generation, you can become president. This contrast to the dictators, the oligarchs, the closed systems, the corruption, all the things people suffer around the planet, is a remarkable reminder of how unique America has been. There's a reason that Governor Schwarzenegger, who could never have been president of Austria, because the concept of a bodybuilder from a rural community heading Austrian society would have been unthinkable. But in America, he could become head of our largest state. And so I think, once again, as Americans, we can take unique pride in what happened yesterday. Third, I would urge you to go back at some point in the next week and reread the inaugural address yesterday, not as a speech. It's actually not, I think, a particularly great speech. It's not in the tradition of Lincoln or FDR or Reagan. I think instead what it is a conversation in which an extraordinarily talented, still very young man, with only a few years' experience in the U.S. Senate, suddenly discovered after winning the presidency in what is one of the most remarkable campaigns in American history, that he's faced with challenges vastly bigger than he imagined. And I think he was sharing with us yesterday a series of thoughts about the core values, the beliefs, and the insights that guide him as he tries to wrestle with this. And my prediction is that you will see President Obama change considerably over the next year or two because he is smart enough and open enough to confront reality, and he is determined to reach beyond partisanship, as he did Monday night by hosting and honoring John McCain at dinner. And so I think you're likely to see a much different, much more complex, and in some ways much more interesting experience. That doesn't mean He won't be perennially pulled by Speaker Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Reid, that he won't be continually pressured by elements of the left, that there won't be a huge fight, maybe the most important structural fight this year, over whether or not Americans should be allowed to retain their right to vote in a secret ballot before being forced to join a union, which I think may well be the biggest single struggle of this year. But I do think that overall he is likely to be much more complicated and much more shaped by what he's about to experience. We have enormous problems in places like Mexico, Pakistan, Afghanistan, North Korea, Iran, Gaza. These are very serious problems. These are killing kinds of problems. More people were killed in Mexico last year in the civil war between the government and the drug dealers than were killed in Iraq. Almost no one in America is covering this as a news item. It's a very serious problem to us, because if our nearest neighbor goes under and their government disintegrates, the scale of mass migration could be literally unimaginable. We have a deep interest in the future of Mexico. Pakistan's a very unstable country that has a substantial number of nuclear weapons. The North Koreans are led by a person who is at best deranged, and that is on a good day. And we have no idea what the North Koreans might do or what they're actually capable of. So I think what you're going to see is the president who's coping with a number of challenges that probably he had not fully prepared for, but who is very smart and is going to work very seriously to try to meet them. Here at home, we're faced with a challenge. Because this is such a large business group and because you currently are in much better shape economically than some parts of the country, I just want to say one or two quick words about the economy in general before talking about health. The best single book I can suggest to all of you to try to understand where we are today is a book by Peter Drucker called The Age of Discontinuities. Drucker actually wrote this book in the late 1960s. His point was that you go through periods where you sort of know what's happening, and there's a trend line, and it could be going up, it could be going down, but you kind of understand that it's a trend line. A discontinuity is a period where the old order has broken down and you actually don't know what the new order will look like. And so it's very hard to discern what we should do. Now, my view of this, which Wayne alluded to my appearance on Fox, those of you who ever watch will probably see me describing this more and more, and in the near future I do a weekly newsletter that's electronic that goes out from my personal site, newt.org, and I'm going to take this up at great length in about 2 weeks. My personal view is that we are fundamentally misunderstanding what's going on, and that we have now thrown away about $1 trillion, and with great enthusiasm, the Congress in the next few weeks will throw away another $800 billion. But that we are sort of like a patient who's going to a doctor who says to us, I don't want to do a CAT scan, I don't want to do lab tests, I really don't know what's wrong with you, and I actually don't have a pretty good theory of how to fix it, but I've got lots of morphine. And so I'm going to give you some more painkiller. And last year we began the, and candidly the Bush administration was a disaster as last year. I'm a solid Republican. I tried to help elect the president twice. I just want to report to you, as a fiscal conservative who believes in markets and deeply distrusts Washington bureaucracy, last year was a disaster. Start with the stimulus package. $180 billion we cheerfully threw away, so we borrowed from you $180 billion in order to send those of you who did not have a high income $600, which you cleverly figured out not to spend because if things were bad enough that we started to be sending you that kind of money, you ought to use it to pay off your debt. And those of you who did spend it bought goods from China. So it had no net positive effect. That was the spring. Then in mid-summer, we discovered there was a housing crisis of such great proportions, we needed to spend $345 billion bailing out the housing crisis, and the battle cry was, we have to do this now or terrible things will happen. And people were panicked into voting yes, and they threw away $345 billion of your money. My One sister who's a retired school teacher told me how badly she felt that she kept paying her mortgage because she realizes in retrospect if she had simply not paid her mortgage, she'd have been eligible to have you take care of her. And now she's paid her mortgage, so she's not eligible, and she feels really guilt-ridden at having done the right thing because now it turned out to be the wrong thing. This is crazy. And then we discovered, having tried to both stimulate the economy and bail out housing, that Wall Street collapsed. By the way, in between all that, we had $4 a gallon gasoline, which came and went. So we have no energy policy, and by the way, gasoline prices will be back presently. We have no long-term economic policy that makes sense. And nobody in Washington slowed down long enough to try to figure out what's wrong with the banks. So instead, we have been throwing money at the banks as though somehow, this is like having a bucket with no bottom, into which we keep pouring water and trying to figure out why there's no water. So the amount you can put into AIG and Citibank in the near future will be breathtaking. And it also turned out the banks weren't particularly interested in loaning money. So this is a large mess. The headline this morning in the Wall Street Journal is stocks collapse on threat of nationalization. Now, remember, that's after a year of trying to bail the system out. So my advice to you is severalfold. First, I believe this problem is bigger and deeper and more complicated, and I think Washington has actually made it worse for the last year. And I think that there's zero evidence that the Obama administration will learn from the Bush administration. What we're likely to get is Bush plus, not a change of course. So we're not going to get real change here. We're just going to get more money spent by more bureaucrats in more truly destructive ways. And one report from the Congressional Budget Office said the stimulus package has parts of it that won't spend out for 10 years. So it's not going to stimulate very much. Second, I think you've got to go back to first principles. These are hard things. This is a conversation we've not had. Let me give you a principle. People who can't afford to buy a house shouldn't buy a house. I know it's bold. Governments that pressure banks to loan money to people who can't pay are setting up a disaster. We live in a world market. Therefore, you had better worry about productivity and you had better worry about cost. Government is inevitably, in the end, part of the same general economy. So your government, whether it's city, county, school board, state, or federal, had better worry about productivity and it had better worry about cost. Now, we are totally out of position today to have this conversation. It is more complicated than Washington is ready for. It involves more common sense than Washington is ready for. It involves going back to first principles. And that's not what Washington wants to do. Washington is terrified that the American people will be upset at being in pain, and therefore Washington wants to find a way to get rid of the pain, even if they don't deal with the disease. And that is a formula for a disaster. We need very deep, very real fundamental change. One interesting assignment I'll give you before I talk about health, if you get a chance, as an organization, you should seriously look at a movie called 2 Million Minutes, which is a study of two Indian high school students, two American high school students, and two Chinese high school students. 2 Million Minutes is 4 years of high school. You cannot possibly see this movie and not realize that we have fundamental challenges if we're going to be competitive in the world market. And we need to rethink from the ground up what we are doing in education. And I would suggest to you we have the same challenge in health. The problems in health are pretty direct. The solutions are complicated and are politically very challenging. But the underlying core problems aren't. Health is a system which has to be recentered on the individual. And here I think some of the work you've done and the Healthy Omaha Project is important, and some of the work that Allegion has done, and I think all of you have an example of their health website at your table. People have got to be recentered on being responsible for their own health care. Now, you may say, oh, that's hopeless. My guess is 95 or 98% of this audience brushed their teeth this morning. I guarantee you in 1800 that wouldn't have been true. I suspect almost all of you have learned how to use a handkerchief or Kleenex to blow your nose. I'll guarantee you in 1600 that would not have been true. There are lots of things we've learned. Many of you have learned not to get drunk and drive. Many of you have learned to actually use your seatbelt, which is the single, other than not smoking, the single best thing you can do for longevity is use a seatbelt. So there are a lot of things we can learn. And so I want to start down that road. We believe it is possible, but this is very different than how do I fix the doctor, or how do I fix the hospital, or how do I fix the insurance company, or how do I fix the pharmaceutical company. That's all political words. We believe at the Center for Health Transformation, you have to fundamentally rethink the system. You have to start by providing information to the individual and giving the individual an incentive to be engaged in their own health. And we believe incentives are better reward than punishment. We don't think Americans respond well to punishment. They get really angry and they'll cheat. But in fact, they respond really well to rewards. And we think that you've got to figure out ways to give people the right information. And then we think you've got to get people engaged in improving their lives. We think it starts with the individual, but it rapidly goes to the community. Because it means rethinking school lunch and rethinking school breakfast. It means going back to 5-day-a-week physical education for K through 12. It means other kind of things. One of my favorite examples of leadership is Mayor Mick Cornett of Oklahoma City, who got up in January of this year, of last year, and said he'd always been 40 pounds overweight. He had never succeeded in losing it. He would try and fail. So he decided to take the whole city with him. And so he announced a weight reduction and exercise plan for all of Oklahoma City. Put a website up where people could enter their weight and they could enter their diet. Got local restaurants to put up a Mick Cornett menu as well as the regular menu. And by September, when I happened to be at a Blue Cross dinner in Oklahoma City honoring state health heroes, and he got the award of the year. And by September, Oklahoma City had lost 175,000 pounds. And the number of people who were bicycling and walking and watching their diet had substantially increased because the community was talking together. We have a project in Columbus, Georgia, working with Microsoft, where we actually have seventh graders who are now walking collectively as a group, and they are recording how many miles a week they walk, and they now have figures who represent them. Avatars who represent them in a computer, and they're actually walking from Columbus, Georgia to Redmond, Washington, and as they go through each state, they're studying it. There's a church I visited recently in Decorah, Iowa, a Catholic church, in which the entire church was walking with pedometers, and they were actually following St. Paul's two trips around the Mediterranean. And so as they'd walk a certain distance, they would then talk about that particular city and what happened there. And the result was people together were trying to improve their health. Now, I don't want to be Pollyanna. That's not the whole story. But it's a significant part of the story. Because if you can get people to control diabetes, and you can get people to exercise and diet, and you can get people, for example, who have rheumatoid arthritis to manage their rheumatoid arthritis, you really dramatically improve the quality of life. You get people who have asthma to manage their asthma. You dramatically improve productivity. You reduce absenteeism. You reduce presentism, you have a healthier and better workforce, and you have lower cost. If you combine with that an electronic health system where you actually keep track of the data and track of the records, and where people begin to move towards electronic prescribing, you get a more accurate system that is vastly more efficient, that is much less expensive, and where information moves in real time. One estimate by the RAND Corporation was that we would save a minimum of $800 billion over 5 years if we had a totally electronic health system. And part of the reason was just the number of tests that are taken and the number of other things that are done that are duplicates or triplicates. All of you had this experience. I'll close this example because I want to have time for just a few minutes of questions. But I want to give you this one example to think about as a community. How often in your life have you entered a new doctor's office to fill out the same forms once again? And I don't know about you, but by the time you get to be my age, and they're asking you, which of these diseases did you have when you were a child? And you're sitting there thinking, now, did I have it, did my two daughters have it, or have my two grandchildren have it? You have a great statewide project right now on health information technology. You have a great city project on Healthy Omaha. You have terrific leadership if you look at what Allegiant's doing with their employees. I think it's possible for you, if you come together as a community, to dramatically improve the health outcomes while lowering the cost of health in a way that will give you a substantial competitive advantage. And I think that as you look down the road over the next decade, this is going to be an economy where people are looking for better, healthier places to live that are also less costly, because we're going to be in a permanent world market environment where we're going to have constant pricing pressures, and our ability to be healthy and creative is going to be a significant part of what we have to do. Thank you for letting me share these ideas with you. And
we asked some folks ahead of time if they had some questions for the speaker, so I'm going to throw a couple at you, if you don't mind. Healthcare costs are challenging for businesses. What can be done to control rising costs, and what's the future of employer-based insurance?
I think employer-based insurance is going to survive because it is actually a very significant form of employee attraction and retention, and because more and more employers understand that they have a vested interest in the health of their employees, because a competitive, productive workforce is at the heart of our ability to compete in the world. I think the number one characteristic has to be transparency of price and quality, getting the information out in the open so people can look at it. And the number two challenge has to be to get the individual directly to take responsibility for a significant part of their health decision-making and a significant part of managing their own health, particularly when you get to chronic conditions, which cannot be managed by doctors and nurses. The individual has to be engaged in taking care of themselves if you're going to manage something like diabetes or asthma or rheumatoid arthritis.
Thank you. One last question. What role should health care reform play in the economic stimulus package?
Well, I've actively worked with Secretary Daschle and have publicly advocated that we have a substantial federal investment in health information technology. The analogy I've used is Eisenhower's 1955 National Defense Interstate Highway Act. I believe if you watch what happened at Katrina in New Orleans and you watch the difference between the people who had electronic health records that survived the hurricane and allowed them to have continuous health coverage without any problems and what happened to people who were in a paper-based system, the difference is so massive that it is in our national interest to get as rapidly as possible to a 100% electronic health system across the country so that wherever you go, if something happens to you, if you're in a car wreck, if you have a stroke, if anything happens and you need health care, we are able to provide instantaneous, accurate information about your health conditions. The number of lives we'll save, the number of mistakes we'll avoid, and our ability to focus on better outcomes and better practices will be so great that I believe this kind of system will not only pay for itself, but in the total quality of life and in the outcomes, I think that it will lead to a significant reduction in illness, a significant extension in life, and will actually reduce the total cost of health care. So that is something I'm delighted they have put money into the stimulus package for that particular thing. And I do believe that having a federal investment to get us over the hump, to get every single American connected electronically, is a very important matter both for national security and for the personal health of individuals.
You've been listening to a program from the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce on Noon Forum. We've heard an address by Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives and founder of the Center for Health Transformation. He spoke on the topic, Creating a 21st Century Intelligent Health System in Nebraska. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday afternoon, January 21st, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jane McCain, Senior Special Events Coordinator for the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.